Hello, this is Clint Beachwood, and it is A Day at the Beach, number 84. You're listening to The Astronauts, the Hearst, recorded back in probably, what, 63? Today's podcast is solely dedicated to an interview I had with Jimmy Gallagher, drummer for The Astronauts back in the early 60s. I just happened to get in touch with him. He agreed to do an interview, and this is it. So I had a great time with him. I recorded this interview about a week and a half ago, a little over a week ago. It was Saturday, July 27, 2013. Great guy. I thoroughly enjoyed my... I basically had two conversations with him. One, the original conversation back a couple months ago, and then this phone interview that you're going to hear right now. So sit back and enjoy. Would love to hear your comments, what you think about this interview and this podcast in general. And it was a fun time to listen to the story of The Astronauts as told by Jimmy Gallagher. Again, great guy, and I thank him very much for taking the time and effort to talk to me and do this interview. Hope you enjoy it. Just happens that the Surf Guitar 101 this year features a tribute to The Astronauts, and hopefully this will help you enjoy the band just a little bit more. This is Jimmy Gallagher. My name is Clint Beachwood. It is A Day at the Beach. Hi, this is Clint Beachwood. I am here with Jimmy Gallagher on the phone. Jimmy in Colorado. Jimmy, of course, is the original drummer for The Astronauts back in the early 60s. Hi, Jimmy. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Clint. I'm just fine.
Good to talk to you. Thanks so much for taking the time to share some of your thoughts and memories about The Astronauts and the music of that day.
I'm glad I can do it.
Where exactly in Colorado are you?
I live in Boulder, Colorado. My wife and I live in Boulder, Colorado. I have two grown daughters that live in Denver. Carol and I, my wife Carol and I, will have been married 50 years coming up in March. We were married during the heyday of the band.
Uh-huh.
And we live in a house that Carol grew up in, and we've lived in this house for over 40 years.
Wow, good for you. Good for you. Not that I'm going to ask you how old you are, but how old were you when the band got going and in the heyday of the Astronauts?
Well, I'm not bashful about my age because I just turned 70.
Okay.
And I don't feel like I'm 70, so it doesn't bother me at all. I'm kind of proud of the fact that I made it to 70. But at any rate, I started playing drums when I was probably in fifth grade in a summer music program that was put on at Boulder High. My mother sent me down there to get me out of the house.
Okay.
So it started, and God bless the woman who taught the course. If you can imagine, there's 30 kids with drumsticks sitting in one chair and learning to play drums on another chair.
Oh, wow.
Had to be a strain. Plus, in the summer, so it was about 100 degrees in the building.
Yeah, of course.
But at any rate, I really liked it. So I went through that program and learned the basic rudiments of drumming and so on. And my parents were both musical, and we'd had music around the house a lot when I was growing up. So I decided that I wanted to, you know, try to play in the grade school orchestra. So my folks got me a snare drum, and then I started playing in the sixth grade orchestra. And I continued to play in junior high and high school bands, you know, as I got older.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it, and it was an easy A grade.
Okay.
You know?
Uh-huh. Sure.
And ironically, I from seventh grade through high school, I had the same instructor, band instructor. He was quite a critic of what I did and probably helped me a lot. I mean, he didn't give me much room. He would say, you know, I know you can do better than that. And he made me battle for first chair every week when I was in the band, you know, to get my stuff going. So anyway,
He probably saw your potential, I would think.
Well, you know, maybe he did. I don't know. I didn't think of it that way. You know, I had no idea of what was going to happen or was about to happen to me as far as the drumming went. So I think it was my junior year in high school. I finally saved up enough money and I bought a used drum set and set it up in my folks' basement and continued to practice just playing along with records, you know. Stan Kenton, my folks were big Stan Kenton fans. Errol Garner. Errol Garner, you know, classic stuff, and that's what I started playing. And then, I think it was in ninth grade, here came Mystery Train by Elvis.
Train arrived, 16 coaches long. Well, that long black train got my baby and gone. Train, train, coming round, round the bend. Train, train, coming round the bend.
Ninth grade, here came Mystery Train by Elvis.
Okay.
And that really got me. I think I'm looking back on it now, and I think that and Cliff Richard's Dynamite are the two songs that really, really sunk into me as far as wanting to get into drumming, you know, rock and roll drumming.
Right. Isn't it funny how one or two songs can really have so much influence on our musical experience and what we really enjoy? I have the same songs when it comes to surf music, but I know exactly what you mean.
It was just strange. And at that point, I had met Bob Dimmon, who was the leader of the band. He was the rhythm guitar player.
For the Astronauts.
The Astronauts.
Right.
And he lived about five blocks down from me, and he also was into music, but he was older than I was. But I'd go down, and we'd sit in his room, and we would listen to that music and listen to that music, and he had gotten a guitar and was just kind of strumming along. He was also learning guitar, and he was in college, and I was still in high school.
Okay, and this was probably the late 50s, I'm assuming.
I think it was probably 1960.
Okay.
Thinking maybe or 59
okay.
maybe
okay
because I graduated from Boulder High in 61, and by that time the band had really started to gel.
Okay,
the original Astronauts. And so what we did is they, Stormy Patterson and Bob had a trio with another guy named Brad Leach who was playing the drums, and that was in June. And they had a gig on the high school radio show and on the local Boulder station. Brad's grandmother passed away, and he left to go back to Kansas to the ceremonies. And so Bob called me and said, "Do you want to sit in on this?" And I'll tell you what, I hopped on my bike, man. I was down there.
you got those pedals going, huh?
Because Stormy and Bob were both older than I was, and I looked up to them, and Stormy also was the state wrestling champ out of Boulder High in 1950. And so he had quite a following of babes, basically.
<Yeah. laughs>
Anyway, I went down there.
So there was more incentive than just drumming then, huh?
It was true.
Okay.
We did the radio show, and Bob said, well, I think maybe we want you to start playing drums. And I was really honored with that.
Sure.
And so when Bad came back, they told him that I was going to play drums. And I don't know whether he was upset or not, but as an aside, years later, Bad became the sheriff of Boulder County. So whenever I was in the county, I always drove at the speed limit because I didn't know if he harbored a grudge or not. So then Bob was in the Sigma Nu fraternity up at University of Colorado on the mm-hmm. hill here.
Okay.
And so Storm and Bob and I and a fellow named Dick Sellers, who was also at Boulder High, started to play like fraternity parties at the Sigma Nu house and the Phi Delta house, you know, on Friday nights or Saturday nights. We just, you know, we just did it for nothing because we just wanted to play. We were all kind of learning the ropes.
Uh-huh.
And so pretty soon it got that we were, all of a sudden we were very popular for this fraternity circuit up there. And so we started playing more, and then somebody told us that we ought to go down to this bowling alley, which was called Olympic Lanes. It had a dance hall in the back. It was a 3-2 beer bar.
Uh-huh.
And audition for this guy because he was, you know, putting together some shows. So we did that. We went down there. There were four of us, and the guy paid us $80 to play. And we were just like in hog heaven.
Yeah.
You know, we got $20 apiece.
Sure.
So then it started to kind of snowball. You know, everybody started listening more to the band and so on, and we started playing a lot more. We were playing at Olympic on Friday nights and then these fraternity parties or whatever on Saturday nights. We played there for about a month, and the guy that ran the Tulagi up on the hill here, the old Tulagi beer club, called us and said, if you come up here, I'll give you $125. Well, we were up there in a heartbeat.
Sure.
And so that's kind of how it all started, because then there were more and more people from that were not from Boulder were hearing us. Pretty soon, we started playing more in Denver, and we got into the like a socialite circuit there, playing deb parties and coming out parties, you know, stuff like that, because we always wore tuxedos on the stage.
Wow,
and
okay.
I think that's what really, you know, got us into like the Denver Country Club and Cherry Hills Country Club to play these different kinds of things.
Right. You were a class act, I guess, huh?
Sure. And we were good and loud.
Okay.
So we were playing a lot of covers, lots of Elvis, Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, mostly, you know, rock stuff. The kids were loving it. They were dancing.
Oh, okay. Don't let it steal your heart away.
You know, rock stuff. The kids were loving it. They were dancing and twisting and,
sure.
You know, everything
mm-hmm.
like that was going on. And then we had played a dead ball at the Denver Country Club for the daughter of a fellow named Ward Terry. And Ward Terry was the RCA distributor for the Western United States.
Wow.
And had his office and his warehouse in Denver. He just really liked the band. And when we played that job, he said, can you play another hour? And he paid us another $100 or something, you know. But he really liked it. And so he put a good word in for us with Steve Scholes at RCA in Hollywood and asked if Steve would listen to us. And so we were still playing at Tulagi. By now we were playing out in the, you know, the Big Eight Conference in Kansas and Oklahoma and Texas, playing all of those kinds of things.
Uh-huh.
And we were starting to, you know, it was really starting to gel, and we were starting to make some money out of it. So we got together, and that was in 62, I think, that we were all in school. We were all going to CU, the University of Colorado.
Okay.
And we said, we've either got to stop this and continue on with school, because it was tough. You know, we were now out 2-3 nights a week.
Right, okay.
Trying to study, and well, something had to give, because, I mean, we were responsible, and we knew we had to figure out what we were going to do. So Bob and I went out to Hollywood on spring break, and we met with Steve Scholes at the old RCA Studios, NBC Studios, at Sunset and Ivar. We walked in. We had a little duct tape. We'd gone to the best clothing store in Bowler and bought new suits. I mean, we were sparkling.
Okay.
And we walked in with the tape, and he was on the phone. And so we heard one side of the conversation. He said, I know. He said, the Beach Boys are killing us in Pomona, and they're killing us in San Diego and Long Beach. And he said, just a minute. He covers the phone, and he looks at Bob. Just a minute. He covers the phone and he looks at Bob and he said, do you guys play surf music? And Bob said, oh, sure.
And had
we
you?
We didn't play any surf music.
Okay.
But, you know, if you're sitting there, you know, Steve Scholes is the guy that handled Elvis.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, this guy was the kingpin. And Lord Terry had gotten us in to see him. I mean, it was a pretty amazing thing that this all went down. So he said, okay. So he told the guys, well, I'm talking to somebody now. I'll get back to you. Well, he said, I've got an A&R man that's going to be coming out. He's going up to Portland to hear a band, or San Francisco to hear a band, and then I'll have him come to Colorado and listen to you guys, and we'll take it from there. And we said, well, okay, we related, you know.
Sure.
I mean, we're going to have somebody come listen to us. So
right, yeah.
We came back to Colorado, went into my parents' basement, and started doing surf music.
Had you played any before that point?
We had not played any surf music to that point.
Okay,
we really didn't know, you know, we kind of knew about it, but it was just
right.
Catching on.
Right. How about instrumentals in general? Because there were a lot of instrumentals in the at that time.
No, we didn't play very many instrumentals. We mostly did vocal.
Rock and roll covers, basically.
Rock and roll covers.
Okay.
So anyway, we're down in the basement. And we're practicing away and practicing away, and we finally get, I forget, you know, 4 or 5 surf songs that we were going to do as covers. And then the A&R man came in, and it was Al Schmidt. And so we all chipped in and paid for steaks, and Bob was married then, so we went to his house, and we fed Al Schmidt a steak dinner, and we all went up to Tulagi, where we were going to perform for the night.
Okay.
And we got on the stage, and we were going to open with, you know, some surf music. And we looked at each other, and we said, you know what? We're just going to do our regular show.
Yeah.
Which started out with There's Good Rockin' Tonight.
Well,
real slow,
the
lights down until about the 15th or 16th bar. And then we hit the lights, and we turn it up and really wail on it. That's how we started our show. It was always, you know, very popular. So we did that. And then we played a few surf songs, but we kind of stuck with our show, and we took our first break, and we went over, and we thought he was going to say, well, you know, that isn't exactly what we had in mind. He was elated. He said, you guys are so good. He said, I'll tell you right now. He said, I'm not even going to think about the other bands I just saw. He said, you're in. So we were just going crazy.
No.
I mean, here we were. All of a sudden, you know, we'd gone from playing the Sigma Newhouse and... to a recording contract with RCA Victor, you know, with the biggest company in the world.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. Now,
so,
just real quick, did you see the movie, the Tom Hanks movie, That Thing You Do?
Yes.
It sounds like it's such a parallel here.
It is. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah.
So then we talked with Al Schmidt. He said, I'm going to send you guys some dubs to work on. And he said, and then in about 4 or 5 weeks, he said, we'll set up a recording date and you guys can come to Hollywood and we'll lay down some tracks and do an album. And so we were just, you know, going crazy.
Yeah.
Well, in those dubs, Al Schmidt was good friends with Lee Hazelwood. And in those dubs was Baja and Movin', which were two Lee Hazelwood songs.
Right.
And that went on the first album. In fact, and the first single was Baja. By Lee Hazelwood.
Right.
I mean, so that single hit. Of course, it went to number one in Denver. You know, everybody was just going crazy over it. And then it bubbled in California, but it never really became a national hit.
Right.
It bubbled under, you know, on Billboard for, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks. And the album itself, I think, made it to maybe number 15, Surfing with the Astronauts, number 15 or 16 on the Billboard. But again, we didn't have a national hit out of it. So, but it was great because we were getting, you know, we made a record.
Sure.
RCA was very enthused. They I think it was about 2 months later, they brought a mobile sound units and we made an album up at Tulagi called Astronauts Orbit Campus, the AOK album.
Uh-huh.
We'll be right back.
campus, the AOK album.
Uh-huh.
And then I think maybe about 3 or 4 months after that, we did another live album in Denver at a place the guy had renamed it the Club Baja. And I think that one's Everything's A-OK. I can't remember.
Right. Now, at this point, had you added the fifth member of the band and brought in that third guitar?
Yes, I'm sorry. I should have backed up on that. What happened was that as we kind of got going, Dick Sellers decided that he was going to join the Navy when he got out of high school. So he did. So he was gone, and we had run into Rich Byfield, who was the lead guitar player and singer for our band, and he was playing around town here. He was from Ogallala, Nebraska, and he'd come into town for the summer because he was going to see you. We joined up with him, and he joined up with us, and it was just great. I mean, he was exactly what we needed and what he needed, you know, as far as the band. And then about 6 months went by, and we thought we'd heard another guy, Dennis Lindsay. And so we interviewed Dennis Lindsay. He came up and played one afternoon at Kalagi, and it just sort of set the sound that we really wanted.
Yeah.
So that's how it all came together. And so that everybody in this group, in the group of fellows I just named, are the original ones, and we're the ones that made all of the albums for RCA.
Okay.
Because
the thing is with the Astronaut sound is you have those three guitars and that bass and those drums, and it is such a powerful wall of sound, not to use the Phil Spector term, but still, it just sets you guys apart from the bands that have, you know, a guitar or even a guitar and a rhythm guitar. You bring in those three guitars, and it's just such a wonderful sound. Even today, we don't have too many bands that have three guitars, but boy, when you get those up on stage, it just sounds great. Satan's Pilgrims comes to mind. Too many bands that have three guitars, but boy, when you get those up on stage, it just sounds great. Satan's Pilgrims comes to mind, and it sounds so good.
Well, and you know, the thing was that we also were fortunate enough because we got in on the new technology at that time, you know, with those Fender Showman amps,
right?
You know, those huge speakers and the first reverb units that Fender created.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
we had access to those things, and I think, you know, that's really what made the sound. And everybody in the band kind of knew what they were supposed to do. It's hard to explain, but there wasn't anybody, you know, flashing in the band. Well, I want to do that part. I want to do that part. There was none of that. I mean, we were all working guys, and we worked together to make it work. And that's a lot of work in there, but that's how it was. And that, as an aside, is why the astronauts also were successful, because we realized that we were very lucky to get where we were, and it was a job. Sometimes it was really tough. I mean, we'd be playing someplace, and they come up, you know, the people would come up and say, well, come on over, we're having this huge party, you know, we want you guys to come over. We'd say, hey, man, sorry, but we've got an 8 o'clock flight to catch. We just, you know, we've got to go pack right. our stuff, get mm-hmm. to the airport. And so that's the way it was. It was a job.
Yeah.
And there was no monkeying around. I mean, there was no drinking. It was well before drugs.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, for us to go on stage, I don't think anyone would have thought about having a drink any more than you would if you were going to work at 8 o'clock in the morning at your job.
Right.
Which was a strange thing.
Yeah.
Oh, it certainly is.
I don't think it exists today, that's for sure.
That's for sure. So anyway, we're plugging along, you know, playing a lot now, all over the country. We got a manager in Hollywood, and so we had a place of contact, and he started us, you know, sending us out, and we were playing everywhere. I was looking through some stuff the other day, and I think we played in Spokane and Kansas City and Miami all in 1 week. I mean, we were on the road all the time.
Yeah.
So anyway, we're plugging along. It's going quite well. You know, we're making money. By then, all of us were married.
Okay.
But that didn't seem to slow anything down. I mean, you know, we didn't broadcast the fact that we were all married. But so everybody had a home life when we came home and so on. So we're home after we've been out 10 days or something, and usually when that happened, we would be home for a couple days, and then we would get together and practice before we went out again. I mean, we really were determined to make it work. So, sitting around the house, the phone rings, and it's Bob Dimmon, and he goes, I think you ought to come over here. I've got something to show you. And I said, okay, you know, I mean, yeah, right, my day off. Well, he didn't, you know, but he was the leader of the band.
Yeah, so okay.
I got in my new car and drove over there, and all the other guys were there, and we all sat down in his living room, and he walked around, and he handed each of us an envelope, and he said, open it up. And we opened it up, and it was a check from RCA for $3,000 for each one of us.
Wow.
And he said, now give them back to me. So we said, wait a minute. And he goes, give them back to me. He said, we're not going to cash these checks until we find out what's going on, which was a smart thing to do.
I see.
Okay. So we called our manager, and our manager didn't know anything about it. And he said, well, let me call RCA and find out what's going on, and I'll get back to you. So we're all sitting there. You know, it was 20 minutes. It probably seemed like 20 hours while we're waiting for the phone to ring. So we pick up the phone. Bob picks up the phone, and he goes, you guys have a massive hit in Japan. And we said, what? He said, yeah. He said, that's where the money came from. He said, you can cash the checks. So Bob hung up on him. We took off at the bank. I mean, because we were really young kids. You
yeah,
know?
And $3,000 was a lot of money.
It was like $30,000.
Yeah, exactly,
in those days.
Yeah.
So anyway, then we got back, and Bob had talked with our manager in Hollywood, and he said that, yes, we'd had this massive hit of Movin', which was Lee Hazelwood's song, uh-huh. off of the album.
Thank you.
had this massive hit out of Movin', which was a Lee Hazlewood song off of the album, and that he said that within the hour he had been contacted from a talent agency in Japan wanting to set up a tour for us to go over there.
Yeah. Now, did you have any idea that your music was even being played in Japan?
Well, we kind of did because, you know, it's a worldwide company, but
right.
we didn't have any idea that, you know, we'd gotten some royalty statements and there would have been play all over the world, and it was fun to look at, you know, gee, Amsterdam, or gee, Tokyo, or gee, Johannesburg, South Africa. I mean, you didn't realize the outreach that RCA had in the world,
mm-hmm. well,
because we were small-town guys from Boulder, Colorado. So we went to Japan the first time for 2 weeks, and that, I think, was in 1964. Then we were very well accepted there. We had huge crowds. And then we came back here and went back to playing, you know, what we'd been doing, the universities mostly, and,
right.
and clubs and
when
so
you,
on. And
when
then
you, when
the
you,
next,
I just have a question.
Ahead.
When you say you played in front of a large crowd in Japan, how many
people were there,
do you know?
They were medium-sized halls that were probably 6,000 or 7,000 people.
Okay.
And, it was really sold out. It was packed, and we were kind of stars. We didn't realize it at that point because, we were just playing like we always did.
Right.
Only we're shooting these surf songs now.
Okay.
So we came home and went back to, you know, the way we were doing, the way we were playing before. And it was after being, you know, sort of in the rarefied air in Japan, it was kind of a drag to come back here, you know, and haul our equipment around and, you know, be playing at the up at Tulagi or up at the Skun Creek Inn in Fort
right,
Collins.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's the same. So then the next year, and because this, Japan has a season of entertainment, which is usually from the middle of January into the winter. And so then when the next year we went back for 3 months to Japan, and we went from Hiroshima to Sapporo. We did all the islands of Japan. We played 2 concerts a day, and it was just amazing. I mean, it was sold out the whole time.
Wow.
So, in fact, the Beach Boys opened for us.
Is that right?
I mean, it was just crazy.
Wow, that's awesome.
So we came home, and then we're back to playing at the Tulagi and stuff, and so it was just kind of a weird deal because we just couldn't get a hit cooking in the United States.
Yeah,
but yet we were megastars in Japan.
Yeah,
and so we were plugging along. All of a sudden, Dennis and I got draft notices because we had dropped out of school to play. Because we were married, that held it off for a while. But then Dennis got tapped, and he left. In fact, he went and joined up and became an airborne ranger. He was really gung-ho.
Uh-huh.
And then in November of 66, I got they caught up with me, and I had to go into the Army. So that was sort of the end of the Astronauts. They continued on with another drummer, another guitar player, and so on, but it never gelled again, and Stormy left and Bob left, and that was kind of the end of it. And I think that went on for maybe 18 months after I left, and when Dennis and I left. So it was a sad thing in a way, but for me it was a graceful way out
of
the business, because after that, and Dennis and I went to Vietnam, after that, you know, the whole music scene changed.
Oh,
you know,
dramatically,
the psychedelic era. And,
right.
And this, that, and the other.
British
and,
invasion, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, and I don't know how I would have handled that. I was still a really young man, but, you know, I'd been married for a while, and so when I came back from Vietnam and finished out the service, finished out my Army stuff, Carol and I had our first child, and I thought, you know, that's it. There's no more road for me.
Yeah.
I'm a married man.
Right.
So it was over for me. I look back on the Astronauts with fond memories, but I really have no regrets because I didn't quit the band. The situation made
right.
me quit, so I don't harbor any grudges about it. You know, like if you got fired from a job, you'd say, oh, it's the boss, or, oh, I did my best, but it wasn't good enough. It wasn't the deal. I just was taken out of the whole picture. I just kind of forgot about it.
Right. Well, you hit it too at its peak. You know, you were there in its heyday, and
yeah.
and you lived that good life for as basically as long as it went on. You know, for surf music and the astronauts in general.
Right, and it was a good life, and it was very rewarding. You know, and we, I don't know, somebody said, one of my friends said one time to me, and this is probably true, he said, you know, in the 5 years you guys were on the road, you probably played more gigs than the Beatles ever thought about playing.
Yeah, sure.
Because, you know, we were out, you know, we played usually 4 or 5 nights a week out around the country. The first year Carol and I were married, we were only together about 30 days because we were on the road the whole time.
Yeah.
But it was a great deal, and I got on with my life, did some entrepreneurial things, raised a family, and it kind of, you know, we think about the astronauts every once in a while because we still get royalty statements from RCA and writing royalties and so on from ASCAP,
mm-hmm.
but I kind of had put it away, and then a year ago, G. Brown, who was the music critic for the Rocky Mountain News for years and the Denver Post, called me and said that he was on the board of the Colorado Music Hall of Fame, and they wanted to induct the astronauts into the Colorado Music Hall of Fame. And so the whole thing came back around. It was just really fun. Two of the fellas, Dennis and Bob, have passed away.
Right.
And Stormy was able to come. He lives in Arizona. Rich Byfield, who is a lead guitar player, chose not to appear. And his reasons are his reasons,
sure.
and I don't hold it against Rich at all. I can understand, because it was a very public thing, and Rich was not a very public person, even when we were in the band. So they got three of the Monsters from Big Head Todd and the Monsters, and Robert Sproul, a lead guitar player for Rose Hill Drive, who both those bands do astronaut sets.
Mm-hmm.
And on September 12th, we did at the Boulder Theater, Stormy and I, and those wonderful young musicians got on stage, and we played a half a dozen songs, and we knocked their socks off. We rocked the place down. It was so rewarding.
Wow. Yeah, that's awesome. Took you back to the early 60s, I bet, huh?
It was so funny, because, you know, I hadn't played the drums, you know, since 1966.
Is that right?
I mean, I'd gotten them out and practiced, you know, but,
yeah.
you know, practicing drums without anybody else around is, you know, sort of like watching paint dry. It's not much fun.
Yes.
But I was nervous about it when I got on stage with these young guys, and Big Head Todd's drummer was there, and he said, well, do you want me to play along? And I said, yeah, because I said, I don't know, you know, how it's going to go, because I haven't played for so long. So he said, okay. And he was, you know, he's really a great guy and a great drummer. So we sat down and we started with Baja, and I look over at him, and he is jumping up and down.
Yeah.
And so we got through, and he said, you know, Jim, he said, you may be 69 years old, but he said, about two beats into Baja, he said, you were 17 again. He said, you are amazing. And I felt so good, because it came right back to me. I mean, it was like riding a bike.
Sure.
All of the crowd that was at the Boulder Theater at this induction, when it was over, came up, and I'm still getting emails and telephone calls with accolades. They said, it was just like being at Tulagi 40 years ago. The only thing that was missing was the smell of the beer. So that's sort of it in a nutshell, Clint.
Well, that is an awesome story, and I don't know if you realize what an impact the astronauts have had in the modern surf music world, but I have a friend who does a radio show at San Diego State's college radio station, KCR. Joe Schrinz is his name. He's on every Saturday morning. And Baja is probably his favorite song of all time. And he's not a surf music fanatic like I am, but it's just such an awesome song. But I made him a CD. I got out a lot of my, you know, CDs, and Baja is covered by just a ton of bands. And I put together, and I filled up this whole CD with different bands' versions of Baja. Some extremely slow, some extremely punkish, grungy kind of a sound. And and people in the surf music world still just love the Astronauts, and it's just an honor here for me to talk to you, because we hold you and the band in such high esteem.
Well, and I'm honored that you told me that, because I've got to tell you, I discussed with you the discipline of the band and everything, and we always tried to give 100% whenever we performed. I was always proud of the way that we served our fan base and the people that paid to hear us. To this day, my name is in the phone book, always has been, and I'll get a call on a Saturday night and somebody will say, "Well, are you the guy?" And I go, "Yes, I am the guy." And they say, "Well, can I talk to you for a minute?" And I said, "Anybody who spent $3.99 on one of our albums gets my undivided attention." And so I've talked to a lot of people over the years.
Yeah.
And it's always fun. And I know there's a lot of people that listen to your podcast that are deep into surfing. And I've got to tell you that I speak for Stormy and Rich and I, that we're very honored that we're held in high esteem by that fraternity of people. I think that's really nice.
Yeah, it is very cool. And the Astronauts are right up there at the pinnacle of the classic surf band and the classic surf sound that everybody just tries to get.
Well, you know, and a lot of it goes back to credit to Al Schmidt, you know, our A&R man,
yeah,
and to Dave Hassinger, who was the engineer and ran the tapes at the old Sunset and Ivar studios. And his diligence in doing the job right is what made those songs, you know, sound like, or those plays sound like they did. In fact, I had a call a few years ago from somebody at RCA, and they said that they were taking those tapes and doing digital transfers on them. And he said, "You know, I'm just an engineer, but I wanted to call you." He said, "I can't believe the fidelity of those tapes and what a great job the engineer and the A&R man did for you guys." And I said, "Well, we knew that all along, because a lot of it was in the wrist there, you know, getting that sound and getting that, you know, that the reverb sound and the depth into those songs."
Well, very good. It's been a pleasure talking with you. I'll go ahead and let you go. You have any other comments or final thoughts you want to wrap up with here, Jimmy?
Well, I just, like I said, I think it's an honor for me to have this all come back later in my life. My kids get a kick out of it. My kids finally got to see me play, which is a big deal. And my compensation for that Hall of Fame performance was I got to get a picture of my grandson sitting on my lap on those drums. And that's kind of what life's all about, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And it comes right down to it.
You betcha.
It really is. So.
Thanks, Clint. I appreciate you taking the time to call me. And if you ever want to talk again, just give me a call.
I will do that. Thanks so much. And I will. I'm looking forward to putting this podcast out and hearing some of the responses from it. It should be quite enlightening. So thank you very much too, Jimmy. We'll be in touch, okay?
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.